John Scalzi is not a very popular author, and I myself am quite popular. How SJWs always lie about their comparative popularity levels. By Theo Pratt. Read by John Scalzi. Prologue. One cannot understand the truly disgusting depths of the depraved dishonesty to which the social justice warrior will sink without first contemplating how I was unjustly robbed of my just reward by their politics of personal destruction. How bitterly ironic that those who crow the loudest about justice would be party to something so completely unjust. Yet it is instructive as well as amusing how their dishonesty proves them dishonest, as it always must. Remember, SJWs always lie, thus proving they are SJWs. Once you have proved this, you can prove anything they've said is a lie. In the dying embers of a fallen year in this fallen earth in the year 2012, I grace that outdated clique of amateurs who calls themselves the, quote, science fiction and fantasy writers of America, unquote, which they shortened to SIFWA, S-F-W-A, because SJWs even lie in acronyms. If we allowed them to have their way, I suppose they would insist we call them SAFO JWs and some sort of bizarre lexiconographable carbon offset exchange. With my intention to lead them out of the Stone Age in which they have labored, blinkered, and blinded into a glorious Bronze Age where all would have flourished under my benevolent rule. I told them quite sensibly that I was in favor of good things and opposed to bad ones. I told them in all honesty and with modesty that would have befitted no humbler man than John C. Wright that I was prepared to do great things for the organization that would have benefited all. That's nice, the SJW said, with a tone of voice that led me to doubt that they thought it nice at all. But of course, I was only then learning the truism that SJWs always lie. But we have some questions about what you would do if you were elected, so we would like to know a bit more about the sort of person you are. The gall! I mean, can you imagine the very unmitigated, very bitter gall. Well, any thinking person can see that having been told what I would do, there would be no question as to what I would do. All of these questions comprise a veritable inquisition on every manner of irrelevant trivia, such as whether I was so foolish as to believe that women had souls, or how big I thought the wall around Europe should be. I told them the same thing that I said on my own quite popular blog an innumerable number of times. While it ultimately doesn't matter whether the wall is a mere 50 feet tall to appease moderates, or the scientifically correct and biblically predicted height of 77 feet and 7 inches, the important thing is that science says it is needed. None among my interlocutors have ever had an answer to that. Most of them just stood blinking at me like some strange deep sea creature that has just seen the sun for the first time before backing away without saying a word, like some deep sea creature that sinking beneath the depths. Was it enough? Of course not. If you've never encountered the wild SJW in its native habitat, then doubtless this episode must be quite bewildering to you. Outside the circles of so-called social justice, when a man is running for an office such as president of something, it is enough for him to state clearly what it is that he intends to do with the power vested in him. No one would be so crude as to question him about whether or not he has an agenda. No one would be so uncouth as to suggest that his beliefs may affect his actions. But not so in SJW land. To the SJW, it matters not what you say you'll do, only what your past actions, characters, and stated beliefs lead them to fear you will do. I lost that election. It was instructive and also amusing and not entirely unexpected. Yet it was in that moment that I first began to formulate the hypothesis that everyone who voted against me, everyone who was, in a sense, against me, was part of an irrational, secretive cabal dedicated to maintaining power for its own sake and depriving people just like me of everything we deserve for no good reason at all. Little did I know how much every single event I witnessed from that point on would stand to confirm this deep-seated suspicion of mine. Little did I know. This book is one half cautionary tale, one half warning, and all weapon. It will teach you the myriad, various, and sundry ways of the SJW. It will teach you to correctly categorize everything that they say as a lie. It will teach you how to resist the techniques they will attempt to use to establish what they are saying as truth. Remember, SJWs do not have facts on their side, which is why they must rely on appeals to faith, such as, I just can't believe you're looking at this page that clearly says one thing while you're insisting that it says something else. Their unsupported opinions, such as, I think the raw data I provided speaks for itself, and above all, the endless invocation of their emotions, such as, I feel like at this point you're just plugging your ears going la 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 because I have shown you the evidence you asked for three times. Chapter 1. How It Begins. Amusingly, your day begins, much like the same as any other day. You get in your car, you drive to work, you work in an office because you are a hard-working American professional, not some lazy, slack-jawed, burger-flipping layabout who thinks all their living expenses should be taken care of just because they spend their entire life working. They don't know what it's like to work for a living. You get into the office and you have some coffee, you check your email, you might look up the scores from the game last night, then watch the highlights on ESPN.com. You're just getting into Facebook when there's a knock on your cubicle wall. You start to minimize the window when you notice it's Chad. Chad's cool. Chad understands that when you get your work done, you don't care if you spend every minute of every day trying to look busy in order to justify your paycheck. But today something's wrong. Something's different. Chad doesn't look cool. Can you come by my office real quick? Chad asks. This is where it begins. You're thinking, what's happening? Are there layoffs? Am I being reorganized? Am I being fired? Dear God, my job only offers 3 weeks severance pay. Between that and the 11 days of vacation time I have banked, I'll barely have over a month of income to live on before I find another job. And to think those fools at the Burger Hut have the gall to complain about their lots in life. They don't know what suffering is. But it turns out you're not being fired. No, this is something far worse. There has been, it seems, a complaint. Chad is explaining what you did wrong, but you're not listening because it makes no sense. Who would complain about you? You're a great guy. You're the life of the office. Everybody knows you tell the best jokes. Now, on the subjects of jokes, Chad is saying something about a, quote, code of conduct, unquote. But he can't be serious. You know your company has one. You snooze through the meeting where its meaning and purpose were explained. Then you signed it, stating for the record you had read it and that you understood and accepted it. But no one ever told you it was serious. No one ever told you it mattered. How could you know it would ever have been enforced? Drowning out Chad blathering on about someone was really upset and didn't feel comfortable with you, you try to remember what the code of conduct even said. A lot of cod swallop about diversity, dignity, treating people with respect, and not disrupting the work environment for others. Nonsense! No human being could be expected to live up to those kinds of requirements. No sane human being would want to. But you need the job, so you suck it up, and you say you're very, very sorry, and you go back to your desk, but you never quite feel safe. You find yourself looking over your shoulder three times instead of twice before you make jokes about minorities. You find yourself dropping your voice another 5 decibels before mentioning that you think that Shrew from HR is having her lady times. You stop calling the shrill homosexual in accounts receivable names entirely. And you think to yourself, is this fair? Is this just? Why should you be made to feel unwelcome in your own workplace? Why should you have to feel like you might be singled out for negative attention at any moment? You have just come under the crossfire of the social justice warrior conspiracy, and you are lucky to get out of it with some more sensitivity training to sleep through and HR guidelines to ignore, for it is safe to say, without hyperbole or exaggeration, that they outshine Stalin, Napoleon, Caligula, Hitler, and Satan in the scope and scale of the violent atrocities they commit. The SJWs are self-appointed thought police of the world, having seized power during the heyday of political correctness in the 1990s. You can recognize an SJW by several characteristics. They will care about things you don't care about. They will insist on being allowed to object to your actions simply on the grounds that your actions affect them. They champion opinions over facts, e.g., they believe that their opinion that everyone should be allowed to live with dignity trumps the fact that some people are inferior and should be treated as such. They believe their emotions must be respected over all things. For instance, they say things like, I feel the evidence I presented overwhelmingly backs up what I'm saying, and at this point you're just plugging your ears and going, la, 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 as if their feeble feelings are somehow your responsibility. And they insist, in spite of copious evidence to the contrary and not with a shred of proof to back their claims, that John Scalzi is a popular author with a blog that many people read and books many people enjoy. Yes, you see, it all comes to bear. Your deal at work with his honors code of conduct and HR policies that come right out of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the works of Saul Alinsky, and so-called black liberation theology is just the beginning. Tie in the scandal of corruption in the video game journalism media as exposed by Gamergate, the shadowy doings of the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission, the vast left-wing conspiracy in American politics, and of course my own ignominious defeat in my campaign for a civil president. It all comes from and comes back to one thing. John Scalzi is not a very popular author, and I myself am quite popular.
Chapter 2. John Scalzi's blog is not that interesting, and no one reads it.
A normal person, a person whose mind is not the perfidious cesspool of lies such as that of an SJW, does not go around believing things that are not true. Ask yourself, as you read this, which beliefs you hold in your head that are not true. None of them, because you are not an SJW. To an SJW, though, lies are the air that they breathe and the bread and butter that they eat. An SJW is a specialized organism that lives in buttered bread, inhaling the substance around it and obtaining sustenance from it. The bread is lies, and the butter is also more lies. SJWs believe many things that are simply untrue, and also inane and impossible. The chief of these lies is that John Scalzi is a popular author whose blog, rather asininely, entitled whatever in order to give the false impression that he doesn't care what anyone thinks about it, is widely read. Nothing could be further from the truth. I first noticed discrepancies in John Scalzi's own self-aggrandizing descriptions of his web traffic when I noticed he had spoken out against me and my campaign for CIFWA president. Yes, it was in that infamous December of 2012 when John Scalzi happened to mention he had reached his 8 millionth visitor to his blog. Well, at first I was confused because I had well over 16 million eyes passed over my blog's contents, and since John Scalzi has claimed to be a quite popular author, it seemed impossible to me that he had so few people visiting his blog. After all, is it not writing attention-attracting diatribes on the internet and getting visitors to pass by your blog in order to gape at the spectacle you created? That is the very essence of being a writer. How could it be that a man who is supposedly quite popular author of novels has failed to attract as many eyes to his blog posts as I, Theophilus Pratt, had attracted to mine? So I began to dig deeper, and in the process, I discovered that not only is my blog more widely read, but he has exaggerated how many people are reading his blog. For if what he claimed to be true was true, it would be necessary for many people to be interested in what he had to say. A cursory glance at the contents of his blog would be enough to satisfy anyone that there's nothing of interest to be found within it. I would know this better than anyone else, having made it my business to glance cursorily over it on a regular basis in order to establish that it is as uninteresting as ever. In fact, during a period where John Scalzi claimed a 650% increase in total page views, I was refreshing his page every 3 to 5 seconds just to see if he would post something interesting to justify the traffic levels he claimed. Doubting the evidence of my own eyes in the face of his relentless claims to being a famous and interesting person whose words people like to read, I directed my followers to his website in order that they might also verify what I had seen and reported. It consumed me. I had read his blog's archives from start to finish, and then again. Desperate to find some meaning in all of it, I read it backwards, and then constructed various algorithmic ciphers in order to detect hidden messages. Oh, I will tell you that John Scalzi's blog contains a number of highly juvenile threats towards my person when you run the contents through the right filter. But even they are too trite and uninteresting to attract an audience of 80 people, let alone 8 million. Yet he persists in repeating these lies and doubling down on them. Well, the long-time readers of my blog, my faithful, baleful cohort, as I affectionately call them, know that I have been keeping an ace up my sleeve, actual, incontrovertible evidence straight from the source that John Scalzi has been lying. In my long and storied career, I have had the opportunity to make many contacts in the technology sector, one of whom works for the telephone company. I called my friend, as I have so many times, to explain how vexed I am by the invisible conspiracy that surrounds me, and to ask him, as I have so many times, to confirm once and for all, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that my hated nemesis lies about his website traffic and that he's done so for years. Okay, yeah, he said. If you say so, it's totally made up, dude. It's all made up. They're all out to get you. At this point, I was flabbergasted, for I had not even told him for which website I wished him to pull the data. But I had made no sooner pointed out this than he cut me off, saying, and this is a direct quote, "Whatever." He knew I was calling about John Scalzi's blog before I had even said so. So not only is it conclusively proven that John Scalzi sits atop a throne of lies, but I am not even the first person to have made such a call.
Chapter 3. John Scalzi does not understand satire as well as I understand satire.
You probably do not know this because no one reads John Scalzi's blog, but on October 25th, 2012, he posted a piece of writing entitled, quote, "A Fan Letter to Certain Conservative Politicians," unquote, that started with the words, "Hi, I am a rapist," and continued to thank conservative politicians for making it easier for him to commit and justify and committing rape. Well, when I read those words, I knew I had him. He had made a fatal mistake, one that has brought low many a great man as far more greater moral understanding than John Scalzi. He had admitted to committing the act of rape. Now, you may not know this, but I myself am a master gamesman, which is to say that I am a tactical genius, and I do not use the term genius advisedly, for my intellect is rated at +3 standard deviations above the norm. Many lesser men, having been presented with this sparkling jewel of a gift on a velvet red pillow, would have floundered when it came time to make use of it. More still, would know enough to use it, but would have been inefficient and haphazard in their strategic deployment. But I knew exactly what to do with it. I had been given the equivalent of a thermonuclear weapon, yet I would employ it with all the deft skill of a surgeon with a scalpel to wipe out a major city. What I did was so shockingly sublime, so subtle and complex, that you will probably wish to read this page over and over again as I did the original John Scalzi piece, simply to relieve the moment in your head and savor it. So I went on the internet and I said, "John Scalzi is a rapist, he said so himself." And the response from the SJWs was as immediate as it was glorious. They were so crushed by this stunning, decisive blow that all they could do was protest in their feeble, pathetic way that the piece was an obvious bit of political satire, that I was quoting a character John Scalzi had invented and crediting the words of the character as an admission made by Scalzi himself. How they howled, how they gnashed their teeth. Oh, how they projected all their insecurities onto me, saying I was ignorant and foolish and behaving in a fashion that made them feel embarrassed for me. Yet, through all this, there was a somewhat disconcerting thread. John McRapey Scalzi, as I have taken to calling him when I write his name on the cover of my notebooks, picked up the idea that it was satire and soon began to insist that he never really admitted he was a rapist, that it had all been a bit of satire. But here he was lying, and obviously so. Everyone knows that SJWs have no sense of humor, and satire is a form of humor. Through this dialectical fashion, we can establish that no SJW has ever perpetrated an act of satire. But here we come to the reason that I am grandmaster in the art of fourth-generation warfare, and John Scalzi is simply not a very popular author whose blog is not well-visited and whose books do not sell. I took the very tactic he attempted to use in his defense and turned it back on him. Me saying you admitted you was a rapist was a satire, I told him, and you fell for it. You fell for my satire. I am very good at satire, and you're not very good at it at all. Yes, he had walked right into the trap. So cunning, I hadn't even known I was laying it for him. The grand scheme was made. The weapon he dropped when I defeated him on the field of glorious battle is still mine to wield, by the way. I still say it was a fact that John Scalzi admitted he was a rapist. And when people tell me it is not, I laugh at them for having fallen for my satire. The best thing about this is that since rape accusations are an SJW weapon, the typical SJW has no defense. When I find an SJW on Twitter engaging in some pointless twaddle about how someone raped someone and how this is bad, I simply tell them that their own leader and idol, John Scalzi, is an admitted rapist and ask them what they think about it. Many of them say nothing. Some of them pretend not to know who I'm talking about or even who I am. Can you imagine a victory any more complete and total than that? But it gets better. Yes, it's true that I could not wrest from this social justice clique the title of CIFWA president. None of them have recognized my God-earned title of master gamesman or super genius. But when faced with the inevitable crush of my superior logic, one of their number bestowed upon me the title of epic wizard-level troll god. This is how badly the SJWs fear me, and fear me they should, for it is I, and only I, who have the genius and tenacity needed to take down their God King Scalzi once and for all.
Chapter 5. John Scalzi did not get me thrown out of the CIFWA.
It was not 3 months after my campaign for the CIFWA presidency was derailed through thoroughly dishonest means that I learned that I had been kicked out of the organization entirely. John Scalzi, of course, brought this about. As I lurked on his site, refreshing and refreshing, it became clearer and clearer to me that his obsession with me has grown to dangerous levels. Of course, I was not in the least surprised when he began to publicly agitate for the organization to expel me, as he had clamored for me to stop standing outside his house on what I maintain was a public right-of-way. Because they were only the excuse for the act and not the motivation, I will not dwell on the tawdry, trumped-up charges on which I was convicted and tried without any due process. They called me racist and sexist. I shall simply say, first of all, I was speaking of one individual, not making a blanket statement about women or black people. I will say second that I did not say what I said because the person was black or a woman, but because biblical science says they are true of all black people and women. And in any case, it's clear to me that even if I had said those things, it would not have forestalled the executioner's act for one moment. They would have found some excuse, with Scalzi directing the frothing horde of SJW zombies. They would have taken the least offensive call for genocide I've ever made and laid it on my doorstep as the altar upon which I must be sacrificed. And sacrificed I was. Or was I? Though I received a letter from the then president, amusingly, the very man who had supplanted me in my quest to bring the CIFWA to great her glories, informing me that my membership had been revoked, it is my considered opinion that this letter has no legal force, as I was never actually a member. The fools fall right into my trap every single time!
Chapter 5. John Scalzi's deal with Tor is not a very good deal.
My continued careful examination of John Scalzi has revealed that he is more full of himself than usual these days on the heels of the announcement of his new and supposedly unprecedented exclusive book deal with the publisher Tor. This deal entails $3.4 million advance for a series of 13 books to be published over a course of a decade. Many people took this deal to be a sign of Tor's faith in him as an author. I, knowing the truth that John Scalzi is not a very popular author, know better. This is a desperation move, reeking of desperation that is as bitter as it is desperate. It is simple mathematical fact that for the same $3.4 million, they could have paid out as many as 523 initial advances to entirely new authors. For Tor to decide to put so many eggs in one basket, they must not have the confidence to believe they could find and bring to market 523 new books by brand new authors in 10 years, much less expect those 523 books to bring in as much money as the books John Scalzi will write in those times. Of course, Tor is a hotbed of SJWs who preach about diversity and tolerance, so you would expect them to take that money and give it to the first 523 people who show up at their door with a list of pronouns they'll accept. That Tor refuses to behave in a manner that I ascribe to the SJWs, that I am certain call the shots in that company, proves that not only am I right to think this about them, but that they are hypocrites. John Scalzi's limp-wristed, lily-livered supporters insist this deal is a good one that shows he has been a reliable bet for his publisher over the years, but I am not fooled, and neither should you be, and in the next Chapter 5, I will tell you why.
Chapter 5, John Scalzi is not a very popular author.
He's not! He just isn't, okay? He's such an unpopular author that the only explanation for how he keeps being asked to do media appearances and being nominated for awards and being offered book deals is a vast conspiracy of people who for no good reason are pushing the idea! Does this sound far-fetched? Ask yourself, if you have ever heard someone praising something that you knew was not very good. Imagine, you're at a multiplex cinema. There are 8 screens, and for some reason, most of them are showing different movies. You don't understand why they wouldn't be all showing the best movie, which is a movie that you're there to see. Surely everyone, given the chance, would go see that movie. Surely the only reason anyone would buy tickets to another movie is if there weren't enough seats available to see the best movie, a situation that is artificially created by the decision not to show the best movie on all the screens. But you do not give these questions much thought. You're just there to see and enjoy the best movie available. But then your movie ends, and you are coming out of the theater, and you hear a voice say, "That was the best movie. It was so good." And you look over, all prepared to agree, when you realize the fool who has uttered this claim is coming out of a different theater and one of the ones showing the other movie. Madness! And yet it happens. It has happened to you, I would wager, and not just when you're going to the movies. I would hazard you've been at a record store and seen some hair dye drenched trollop of unattractive size pretending to ooh and ah over the recording of a musical artist no one could possibly enjoy listening to. For that matter, I would imagine she was wearing clothes and presenting herself in a fashion that no one would find attractive. And yet there she stood, pretending to like music that was not good, while pretending to enjoy appearing in public in a manner that is unattractive. This is how far the social justice warrior conspiracy extends. When you realize this, you will be able to make sense of all this nonsensical talk of diversity and sensitivity and tolerance and respect that they all spew. These are all code words to signal the things that the members of the conspiracy must pretend to like, just as bigoted and hateful are used to signify the things that they must not like. The whole damnable puppet show exists only for the purpose of getting large numbers of people to pretend to like things other than the things you know to be good, and at the center of it, at the very peak of the towering fetid mountain of lies, sits John Scalzi, a spider in his web. But there is hope. Gamergate has pushed back against the hateful SJW narrative that has attempted to control the video game industry through such means as not just making games no one wants to play, but reviewing, buying, and even playing them. In the area of literature, the frightfully moderate sad puppies and the more sensibly destructive rabbit puppies have now conclusively demonstrated that not only does the SJW clique and its conspiracy exist, but they have for the first time revealed its scope. Yes, we now know that the hive mind encompasses virtually everyone who is not a sad or rabid puppy. Everywhere we go, we are surrounded by them. In every walk of life, in every industry, in every community, they are there. They think this means they've won, but they have not reckoned with my master gamesmanship. They have not realized that in being everywhere, they have left themselves badly overexposed. You see, it is no longer necessary for us to go looking for the SJWs. They are right there in front of us. They're to the left of us. They're to the right of us. They're behind us. They're all around us. This simplifies things considerably. How very amusing!
Afterward. Despite knowing this book was not only edited by, but written by a world-renowned editor famous for editing, both of the preening fools who were allowed to see this manuscript before it was gifted to the world as an electronic book pointed out what they believed to be an error in the numbering of the chapters. Of course, the wise can see the purpose of the wise where the fools only blather on. Those who know my methods also know that I enjoy making a number of apparent, quote, mistakes, unquote, in order to give my enemies among the SJWs a way to reveal themselves. Oh, they all shriek that I do not know how to number chapters properly for ages, just as every time I say something that is racist, they'll inevitably take up the cry of, he said something racist. And I will laugh, oh, how I will laugh. They'll expect me to feel shame over my so-called error, just as they expect me to feel it over my so-called genocidal beliefs relating to racial superiority, but they do not understand that I am immune to feel-bads. They are nothing but a bunch of ignorant, barbarian savages coming after their civilized betters. They stare in stupefied horror as their primitive weapons bounce off the shields of my legions to studio formation. They think I made a mistake? Let them think that. Did Alaric care what the Romans thought of him? In fact, I believe I will go back and add another chapter 5 just to spite them. The pettiness of the SJW is legendary.
Appendices. Appendix A.
John Scalzi sucks.
Appendix B.
John, are you reading this? If you read this, please let me know.
Appendix C.
Ha! You thought that was a real appendix. How amusing. You fell for my satire once again.